The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On today's show, we'll hear part two of my conversation with Petra Schultz, one of the co-founders of the organization Moms Stop the Harm. But first, a suit has been filed against the Government of Canada in British Columbia Supreme Court that seeks to have sections of Canada's Controlled Drugs and Substances Act that prohibit drug possession declared invalid and stricken. The suit was filed by the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and four individuals. Here now is Dustin Clout, one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs.
As I had previously mentioned, it was launched in British Columbia. It is related to a federal criminal law. However, the other party is the Attorney General of Canada, the federal government. We have CAPUD, which is a national organization, but is a registered nonprofit society in British Columbia, as well as four individuals from British Columbia. They have a cross-section of various interests and experiences. We have folks who have lived experience in rural areas, in the urban areas. We have folks from a variety of genders and gender identities. We have folks with a variety of racial backgrounds. We have folks who have used a variety of different substances, both presently and in the past. And we have folks who are loved ones of persons who use drugs that have passed on. So a wide cross-section, and part of the goal of this was to show a wide factual matrix and all the varied ways that the criminalization of the possession of drugs and certain elements of trafficking lead to an inordinate amount of harms and disadvantages that these folks face. And the nature of the challenge is one that is targeting that piece of criminal legislation. It's not the criminal code which houses most criminal offenses in Canada. Of course, the federal government has the jurisdictional authority over criminal offenses. Provincial governments do not. They have some other offenses, but not the criminal offenses. The Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, and now the new Marijuana Act with respect to some elements of marijuana that are still criminalized, are the two pieces of legislation that criminalize the possession of drugs and the trafficking of drugs. This challenge is specifically targeting the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and two sections of that act. The first being Section 4, which is the simple possession section. The goal with that is to have a ruling from the court declaring that that section is unconstitutional for a variety of reasons. I'll go into the specifics of the charter rights involved later, but the hope with respect to the remedy is that section gets struck in its entirety to give clarity to persons who use drugs that they cannot face enforcement or prosecution merely for the simple possession. The other challenge is that possession is referenced in many other places throughout the Act in the other offenses. In the Section 5 offense, in the Section 6 offense, which is import and export, and in the Section 7 offense for production. So the goal is also to get any reference to possession struck. And the hope is that the phenomenon that's called upcharging, where, you know, really a person is just possessing the drugs for their personal use, but the police or the Crown deem that they have a sufficient threshold and that's for the purpose of something else, and they charge them with possession for trafficking, possession for import-export. The goal is to have those sort of upcharging provisions also eliminated, so there has to be some other evidence of export and import or of what we call commercial trafficking and not necessity trafficking or of production in order to bring a charge for it. And then with respect to Section 5, the other goal of this action in terms of the remedial relief is to get a remedy which is known as a read down. Essentially, that section will still be in place, but the courts will say there's certain circumstances in which have to be read down from the section because it's unconstitutional to criminalize those particular elements. And this action defines necessity trafficking as the basis for that read down. To criminalize a person who is trafficking for the purpose of providing a safe supply. This could be an example of someone in a supervised consumption site who is sharing their substance that they know is a safe supply. They've had it tested with others to ensure that they have a safe supply. this could be a heroin compassion club, which we've been seeing with the Drug Users Liberation Front in Vancouver, something along those lines, where they know they have the tested drugs and substances, and then they provide them and they ensure that folks aren't otherwise going to the illegal market to procure that supply, where they face the risk of overdose and death and other tragic consequences to their health. The other instance is when a person is, because of the illegal supply and the associated high costs and, you know, the associated barriers that criminalization places on them securing income from other sources that aren't legal in other ways, where they sell drugs for the purposes of maintaining their necessities, you know, food, clothing, housing, or they sell drugs solely for the purpose of affording drugs from the illegal market, which are at exorbitant rates and difficult to procure otherwise. Those are three potential examples of necessity trafficking that Caput and the individual co-plaintiffs feel should also be decriminalized. And the hope is to get a remedy that will effectively do that. The scope is not limited to any one particular substance that is in the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. There's various schedules that set out the varying penalties that are associated with the particular drugs. But it is the view of my clients that the stigma associated with criminalization, the fear associated with criminalization, which collectively creates coercive forces and coerces folks away from getting recognized harm reduction, which also coerces folks into an illegal market that has this dangerous supply, that can only be alleviated, and the supply itself can only be properly regulated and ensured to be safe when it's all drugs that are controlled are struck down with respect to possession and read down with respect to the trafficking elements. It's not limited to just, if we were to say, okay, well, how about opioids? You know, 95% plus of the opioid supply is adulterated. If there was a read down with respect to just opioids and not a strikeout and just reading down opioids or striking out opioids from the schedule, that likely won't have the full optimal effect. No doubt it would have some effect, but not every individual entirely knows the full composition. There could be some elements of a stimulant within the what they think are opioids. And in any event, you know, the stigma is generalized for all substances. Without that complete action of decriminalization to remove that stigma, to remove that fear of potential law enforcement, you're not going to have the ultimate optimal effect of reducing the harm to folks' lives, to their liberty, security of the person, and to eradicating the discriminatory effects of the laws. The basis that underpins the request for this declaration and for these various remedies. Now, what rights are implicated? There are three potential rights that are implicated and that are pledged in these pleadings. First off, in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is Canada's constitutionalized national bill of rights that applies to every government in Canada, there are the rights in Section 7 to life, liberty, security of the person. There are the rights in Section 15 to equality. And there's the right in Section 12 to be free from cruel and unusual treatment and punishment. My clients are alleging that all of these rights are potentially implicated. Most prominently, the Section 7 rights to life, liberty, and security of the person in two respects. First, when you have an illegal supply, which by its very nature means that there isn't a regulated supply, and the government just leaves the space open for the illegal supply to flourish, and we see this act of poisoning, that in and of itself is creating a threat to folks' lives. We've seen since 2016, when there was the public health emergency declared in BC, and when fentanyl adulteration was widespread first reported, I think the figures that we have are almost 25,000 Canadians have died. That is a really tragic and frankly disgusting amount. And in addition to that, there's many other negative consequences from forcing folks into that illegal supply. You know, many of the overdoses lead to hypoxia, and then have, you know, cognitive damages for the folks that do survive. There's other negative health consequences. Criminalizing compounds that in that it causes them to have to rely on that drug supply. The reality is the war on drugs has been going on for a long time and people continue to use drugs. It hasn't had the deterrent effect that government policymakers had initially intended, if at all. And to Paul's point, many of the criminal prohibitions in the first place were racist motivations. They weren't necessarily rooted in a good faith policy intervention. Whether they were maintained on the books in the future for some, you know, paternalistic ideal or moralistic ideal is something separate. But we see that there is this damage to human life, this damage to human health that is occurring. And on top of that, whenever you have incarceration imposed, there is automatically an effect on the liberty interest involved in that right as well. And then when you show the connection there, and then there's also a further element in terms of people are barred from accessing scientifically proven harm reduction that could save their life and could save them from grievous injury because of the fear that's created by the criminal law, because of the stigma that's created by the criminal law. This is causing folks to resist going to supervised consumption sites. This is causing folks from not being forthcoming with doctors and seeking things like opioid agonist therapy. It's preventing folks from ensuring that they have a friend present when they are using who can revive them using naloxone or calling emergency services to potentially revive them as well. The pernicious effect of the criminal law is that harm reduction is not able to be fully optimized. That in and of itself is also a threat and impact on life and security of the person, human health. Now, when you can show that there are all these negative effects that are caused by the law with respect to the rights to life, liberty, and security of the person, then it flips in terms of the legal analysis. You have to show that there is a violation of a principle of fundamental justice, a core legal principle of importance needs to be shown. And where these cases have kind of gone in the past, most notably in the PHS, or also widely known as Insight decision that came out of British Columbia, is that previously, just the fact that incarceration was imposed for Section 4 simple possession resulted in that first stage of the legal analysis being where there was a right violated. But it failed on the principles of fundamental justice because the court said, well, in the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, there is an effective safety valve that cures that unconstitutionality because there was Section 56 exemptions for, in that case, the supervised consumption site. There is a mechanism whereby exemptions to criminalization, we can turn the dial on the degree of criminalization in certain contexts, means that that violation is potentially cured. Well, cue today, 5 years out from 2016, and almost 25,000 people who have died, all the policy reform mechanisms that have been proposed to some degree rely on decriminalization. SESs, OPSs have relative decriminalization. The Good Samaritan Act, decriminalization. The decriminalization of control over naloxone. All of these have at their heart some element of decriminalization to try to stop this human toll. It hasn't effectively done it when we see all these deaths and deaths continuing to rise post-COVID for a variety of factors. Okay. That is a failure of that safety valve. And that's the basis in Section 7 that previous case, there's different facts here at play. The social facts and the legislative facts at play are completely different. There's different arguments being ventilated. So Caput and my clients are confident that the courts won't rely on conventional arguments like stare decisis, saying that this matter has been decided before in cases like Malmo Levine, which tried to get legalization of marijuana and failed through the courts, and the Insight decision, which was more narrow in its scope. Now, Section 15, equality rights. What needs to be shown is that there is a distinction drawn in the law and that there's a disadvantage that is perpetuated for marginal groups who can pin that disadvantage to some prohibited ground of discrimination. And the evidence definitively shows that racialized Black, Indigenous, and other persons of color disproportionately are affected by criminalization. They're disproportionately deprived of their liberty. They disproportionately face consequences flowing post-conviction. There's other groups as well. There's emerging evidence that the LGBTQ plus community also faces disproportionate outcomes with respect to drug criminalization. Further, in instances where someone is medically diagnosed with a drug dependency disorder, criminalization is perpetuating a disadvantage on the basis of their protected mental or physical disability as well. So there's multiple bases in which the Section 15 equality rights are invoked. And finally, cruel and unusual treatment and punishment. In other contexts, specifically sentencing, you know, where there was too onerous of criminal punishment placed upon drug trafficking, courts have, it's in the context of mandatory minimums, particularly the Lloyd decision, courts have struck down mandatory minimum clauses. And my client's argument is that there's similarly, and as was mentioned in those cases, that with respect to certain drug offenses, there is a reduced, if not no, moral blameworthiness warranting punishment. And continued punishment for those actions is grossly disproportionate to them. And in that case, there is a violation of Section 12 as well. I noticed that I've taken up to an hour. I think I have about two more minutes. I'm just going to power through before I turn the floor over to questions. I'd also note that there's important privacy interests that are protected by the other charter interests and important bodily autonomy and individual liberty interests with respect to folks who use drugs having the choice over what goes into their bodies that are also implicated in this. And I note that there are several foreign jurisdictions that have taken decriminalization approaches, and there's evidence of success. Most notably Portugal, whose model has resulted in less overall drug deaths, less overall drug consequences, and generally a decrease in drug usage. There might be great debate as to whether the Portuguese model is the best model for Canada. That's not what this case is seeking to show. It's just seeking to point out that where decriminalization of some variant of model has been used, it has been effective at, bolstering folks' human rights and stopping the harms to their life, liberty, and security of the person. And now we see other jurisdictions with perhaps less evidence because there's newer reforms, the example being Oregon, who did it by some form of decriminalization of simple possession by a ballot measure a few years back. Several courts, most notably in the context of marijuana, have also previously found internationally that simple possession offenses aren't constitutional. One of them was the Constitutional Court of South Africa with respect to recreational marijuana several years ago in the Prince decision. I happened to be working for that court at the time that that decision was being heard. That was part of the motivation why when Kapood came to me, I said, yes, I'm willing to take this case forward because I saw that the legal arguments could be marshaled to bring about this sort of change in that foreign jurisdiction. And furthermore, my personal interest in this is related, as Donald has said, in seeing the devastation that my home community of Medicine Hat has suffered and that my current city, Vancouver, is also suffering. It's very much an epicenter with respect to many of the overdoses. And this being an impact to my family personally, I had a cousin who very nearly passed of an overdose in the last year. So it's a matter that is something that is very profound for me personally. And I was happy to help Kapood and the individuals ventilate these arguments. And the next step is essentially waiting to see what the government of Canada will respond with. And then we'll go further into the litigation process, which is likely to take several years.
That was attorney Dustin Clout speaking at a news conference about a lawsuit filed by the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and four individual plaintiffs that seeks to have sections of Canada's Controlled Drugs and Substances Act that prohibit drug possession declared invalid. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Staying with Canada, I had the honor recently of speaking with Petra Schultz, one of the co-founders of the organization Moms Stop the Harm. We heard part one of that conversation on last week's show. Now for part two. Your Moms Stop the Harm is working with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs on their suit. Now they're suing the federal government in Canada, yes, or is that BC?
Well, how it starts, it's with the BC in a piece of BC court, and then it could go federally if the suit is successful there. So taking it to the human rights court there is the first step, and it's a human rights claim. And what they're saying is that the criminalization of people who use drugs is a violation of their human rights, and that all charges for possession and what they call as subsistence, subsistence trafficking, that should be struck from the criminal code. That's their point. And there are four litigants, and there are three people who, from different perspective of lived experience, and one of our moms, who's a litigant on behalf of her daughter, Ola, who lost her life. And Deb contends that if Ola would not have been criminalized, and if Ola would have had access to safe supply, she would not have died. So we joined that lawsuit with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, and it was submitted to courts in BC, but hopefully we'll go further. It's early days. And then we have another lawsuit in Alberta that we are involved in.
That was the other one I wanted to ask about. That's Lethbridge Overdose Prevention Society.
Yeah, Lethbridge Overdose Prevention Society and Moms Stop the Harm. We're taking our government here in the province of Alberta to court. Actually, for Moms Stop the Harm, my name is on the affidavit as the official plaintiff. I must say it was really scary to sign that. You don't just take your government to court lightly. And it took me a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to arrive at the point that I was brave enough to do that. And I'm thankful for the support of Moms Stop the Harm. There's another member here, Kim Porter. Kim and I, we kind of looking after the lawsuit in Alberta. Kim does a lot of the PR stuff on it. And what has happened here, we got ourselves a little mini Trump. His name is Jason Kenney. He shows a total disregard for science and the public health, not just when it comes to substance use, but also when it comes to COVID. He's done some really horrible things, and our hospitals are overrun. Our ICUs are beyond capacity because of his action. But what he's done, he's shut down two of the busiest supervised consumption sites, and in the city of Lethbridge Overdose Prevention Society, they, as a response to the site being shut down, they tried to launch an overdose prevention site, and they're still in the process of working on that, but they're just facing so many challenges in that regard. And one of those challenges comes through the government. They put new regulations in place. And these regulations require people to give their name, birth date, and healthcare number. And then their use of an overdose prevention site or consumption site will be reported to the health authority, like your health insurance plan equivalent. And of course, people don't want that. I mean, we did a survey of people who use it by injection. And more than half of them that said they would not use the sites at all, or would be very hesitant to use it if they'd have to give their name and health number. And that is what Lethbridge Overdose Prevention Society and us, that's what we are fighting the Alberta government over.
You're doing a lot, and you're doing some more stuff, actually. There's another thing that you were telling me about, boots on the ground.
Yeah, Boots on the Ground. That's not a mom's, that's a separate group here in Edmonton. So Boots on the Ground includes some Moms Stop the Harm members, but they are a local, they're a couple of young women, one who has worked with youth at risk and one who has a son who is houseless in downtown Edmonton. And they go out with harm reduction supplies, and I asked if I could join them, because you do all this work, you give talks and meetings, and you do policies, you go to conferences, and it can be hard to know that you're actually making a difference. But I know every naloxone kit or Narcan kit I give out could save a life. I know all the pipes and needles we give out will stop infections, and the cigarettes we gave out will somebody may feel better, and the chocolates and the candy will give them a bit of sugar in that moment. So it just felt really good to go out and be with the Boots on Ground team here in Edmonton. There are several groups that go out. They're the Water Warriors, Bearclaw, and then there are some organizations, some agencies as well that go out. Because our consumption site, one of the busiest consumption sites in Edmonton, got shut down by our mini Trump. The overdose rates, the ambulances just don't stop in downtown. We've had so many people going down, and we have benzos and fentanyl now. I don't know if you guys have benzos. You use Narcan and the person starts breathing again, which is great, but they still are not conscious. And then you still have to call the ambulance and get them off to a hospital. And now, thankfully, we have a health system where when they arrive, they won't get a bill at the hospital. So at least people who are poor and without a home, they can't afford to go to a hospital, which I'm thankful for. But it's good to go out with Boots on Ground, and it's also good to talk to people and get the idea. Like, I have had this man give a long speech to me and said, that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. And then he proceeded to explain it all to me, that what we need is connection. And I thought, wow, this is brilliant. Why doesn't some politician come down here and listen to this man who's standing in front of his tent where he's going to sleep at night?
That was my conversation with Petra Schultz, one of the co-founders of the organization Moms Stop the Harm. Find them on the web at www.momsstoptheharm.com.
This is crack cocaine, seized a few days ago by drug enforcement agents in a park just across the street from the White House. It could easily have been heroin or PCP.
And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for the Drug Truth Network, distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network to stations around the nation. Please support your local nonprofit community and public radio stations by donating or becoming a volunteer. Century of Lies is also a free download and podcast. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net, where you'll find a link to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.